the coverage has been, it's full of, you know, black hat hackers, and it's full of drug dealers, it's full of child exploiters, and so on. And the unfortunate side effect of that is that, you know, that's what people think it's for. And I think that that social construction of the dark web as for these activities is a very powerful force.
Well, thanks for joining me, Robert. I came across your work, you know, weaving the dark web, your book, Weaving the Dark Web, Legitimacy of Freenet and Tor and ITP. Uh-huh. And currently, like, I'm working on the sort of next generation cipher space called Logos. And I'd been thinking about public programmable blockchains and how they can have their own sense of legitimacy. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't really come across anyone else thinking about these ideas until I came across your book. And I sort of I just wanted to chat to you about it and see, you know, your thoughts and convey that to our viewers. But moreover, I think you're working on a new book as well, right? I think called Move Slowly and Build Bridges, about alternative social media, and mm-hmm. With a focus on, you know, the Fediverse and the ethics around that.
Yeah.
And for the past 9 years or so, you know, one of the main projects we've been working on is Status, which is, alternative decentralized peer-to-peer messaging or super application mm-hmm. built around Ethereum. I guess, like, before we get into the weeds, would you like to introduce yourself, tell us a bit more about your background and then what you're all about?
Sure. Yeah. My name's Robert Gale. I'm an associate professor at York University. I'm in the Communication and Media Studies Department. I also have affiliation with a big grant project called Connected Minds. I have a research chair. It's got a longish title. It's the Ontario Research Chair of Digital Governance for Social Justice. But basically, what I take that to mean is focusing on how communities govern themselves online, how they use various technologies to build communities and connect to one another. And so, as you mentioned, my current book project, I'm focusing on the Fediverse. I've had this longstanding interest in alternatives to what I call corporate social media, alternatives to Facebook and Twitter and so on, which was a pretty sleepy topic until November or so of 2022, when Elon Musk bought Twitter. The connection there with the dark web book you might have picked up is that the one of the entry points I had into the dark web was that people running alternative social media on the dark web. And I found that to be really fascinating, particularly at that time when Facebook was so dominant and so concerned with real world identities. I thought, this is really fascinating that people are leaving that behind for socializing in these networks that are meant to protect anonymity of readers and creators of content. So that's kind of the thread I would draw between the two projects there.
Right. Okay. Interesting. And like, what are the motivations for even caring about this? And, you know, obviously you're dedicating a large portion of your life to these ideas.
Yeah. Personally, my motivation was my doctoral research. So I was a PhD student at George Mason in the cultural studies program. And this was in 2005 to 2010. And this was right as the whole Web 2.0 discourse was exploding. So user-generated content, I think if I remember rightly, it was 2006 when you was a person of the year. And so Time Magazine had like this special edition with a mirror on it, so you could hold it up and be the person of the year. And the argument in that issue was that we are the media, right? It's no longer a top-down centralized broadcast model. And I was looking into this and seeing at the same time, YouTube get purchased for something like $1.6 billion by Google, Facebook growing rapidly, and seeing this, you know, monopolization of sociality online, and getting really concerned. So here on the one hand, we have all of us socializing online, connecting to each other, making posts, liking those posts, sharing, and that feeding these growing monopolies. And so my first book, which grew out of the dissertation, it's called Reverse Engineering Social Media, was a critique of the political economy of that. Basically, our free labor fueling these now extremely valuable companies. And working through that, I got to the end and realized like it's not enough to do criticism, right? We can critique Facebook, Meta, Twitter, Google all day long. What we need to do is embrace activists who are building alternatives that keep that ideal of us being the media alive. So that's when I started turning to look at various projects, and their motivations are somewhat similar, often stemming from a criticism of the monopolization of online sociality, but also, you know, particularly post-Snowden, privacy concerns, trying to keep privacy or anonymity alive on the internet. So you see a variety of motivations, and sometimes those motivations clash. I think we can see that even today with the Fediverse, as popular as the Fediverse has been. But at the end of the day, I would argue to my fellow academics, you can't just critique, you have to explore potential solutions and then, frankly, critique the solutions, right? Like we need to use our critical faculties to improve the solutions that people are bringing forward.
Right. Okay. I guess like when it comes back to that political economy, you know, with big tech or, you know, corporate social media, this corporate social media concept, do you view that as kind of like a form of like feudalism in a way, where like the users are almost like serfs that right. are having their data harvested from them, and then obviously that being turned into revenue in some form?
I think that's not the worst metaphor in the world, and a lot of people have reached for that metaphor. So the most recently, the work of Nathan Schneider, he talks about implicit feudalism, I believe is his term, in his book on online governance. And there are several other books, I can look them up and share links, that basically use the feudal metaphor.
Right.
I came at it really from a Marxian political economy perspective where, you know, you work, you produce value, and the extra value is taken from you. So what is the value that we produce? We produce ourselves. You know, arguably we produce who we are through social media. We declare what our interests are, who our family members are, who our friends are. We explore media. We talk about, you know, do all the things that we do, you know, offline. And we do that through these systems, and the exchange, you know, the classic phrase, you know, if it's free, you're the product. The exchange is we give up our data for access to become ourselves, which I found to be, frankly, deeply offensive. And so that's why I started turning to people who, like me, said we can do better. But then the question about what that better looks like is where, you know, the devil is in the details, so to speak.
Right. So it sounds like, you know, you are tackling this on the sort of academic or theoretical front, but it sounds like there's almost like a frustration that you want to become more practical and see more explorations in this. Yeah. Do you have an active hand in that as well? Or like, you know, what's your role? Are you like working towards a solution for alternative social media?
Yeah, I see my role as mostly supportive and documenting, but I do, it's tricky because one of the pressures you face as an academic is to be an objective observer. I don't believe that that's possible, but that's one of the poses or ways of being as an academic. And so I would sit back and document what I see and criticize, right? But there are other strands of academic engagement that are much more participatory. So ethnography is one example. I'm not saying that I do full-on ethnography. I don't go and, you know, live somewhere else. But I do a variant called digital ethnography where I participate in communities. And so to give an example from the dark web book, I participated in a dark web social networking site. As you know, I came to it anonymously. I built a pseudonym. I built a stable identity over time. And there's a variety of ways you signal that on these social networks on the dark web. And at one point, we were talking about privacy, and we realized that the site didn't have a privacy policy. So I collaborated with one of the site admins to write the privacy policy. And it was basically about collective privacy. Act in a way that will protect the privacy of all members of this social medium. So there are moments when I feel compelled to engage, and currently I and one of the admins of a Mastodon instance. So this is a Fediverse technology. I'm one of the admins of the instance that the Association of Internet Researchers, which is an academic professional group, they set up an instance of Mastodon and asked me to run it. And so I worked with content moderators on our in our community and community members to write our code of conduct. And so, you know, these are active engagements and they can shape, you know, networks, however small. I think the real payoff here is that, to go back to Meta and Google, like, I can critique them all day long. They're not going to listen to me. Or maybe they might. They do hire academics from time to time, and then you can be inside and maybe believe that you're shaping them from the inside.
Right, but they have a stronger set of incentives that are pulling them in a different direction. Right?
Yeah, whereas if I get actively involved in a Fediverse instance or a dark web social networking site, I can actually help shape it using my research and ideas.
Yeah, very cool. I'm kind of curious, like, you know, a code of conduct, you know, helps establish basically a set of norms, you know, for that community to adhere to. And there's a couple of things that I want to unpack here. Like, I'd love to talk about, you know, the sort of different motivations that you've seen. Like, we touched a little bit on privacy, and I'd like to go into that and, you know, and maybe the different approaches that are expressions of those motivations. And then, like, downstream from that, you know, like, what are the sort of enforcement mechanisms that are involved, you know, around upholding the social norms within these different approaches, such as a code of conduct. But then, like, the other thing that I think I'd be very curious to hear about as well is you know, this intersection, like, identity becomes very important in social media, yes. Right? And I'd be very curious in your participation through these different mediums, how they may have, like, shaped your identity or influenced your identity, and, like, maybe they've carried into your core identity in the meat space. I don't know if, like, you've thought about that at all, but
I have. Well, there's a lot there. Maybe we can turn to codes of conduct really quickly.
Sure.
I think. Yeah. I have a chapter on them in the new book. I think they're extremely important in the case of the Fediverse. So I don't know how much you know about the history of codes of conduct in open source communities, free and open source communities, but they were, and to a certain extent remain, controversial because in free and open source software development, the traditional norm has been be excellent to each other. You know, we can all just interact and be human to one another, and we can produce code. And the second norm
is a Wayne's World reference.
What's that?
is that a Wayne's World?
I think it is. Be excellent, man.
Or is it Bill and Ted? I can't remember. It was one of those. Anyway,
you know, I think you're right. I think it was Bill and Ted. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, you would see that. And a second value there is it's a meritocracy. So
right.
It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter what you believe. It doesn't matter your politics. What matters is your code. Your code,
right.
The best code is going to inevitably bubble up to the top. But critics of both of those positions have argued that in the first case, there's been some, frankly, abhorrent behavior at free and open source conventions. So the Geek Feminism Wiki has documented, I think it's no longer active, but it was documenting, you know, harassment and abuse and misogyny and transphobia at free and open source conferences. And as a result, I haven't looked at the latest demographic data, but a few years ago, there were reports coming out saying that, like, among all these different tech sectors, free and open source software actually has the worst diversity, least representation of Black and brown people, least representation of women. The activists who put forward codes of conduct argue that that's because the be excellent to each other man approach is inadequate to addressing those concerns. And so you need a code of conduct, you need statements about values, and you need, as you mentioned, sanctions for people who violate those norms. That's controversial because obviously, you know, you'll hear people say, well, this is Orwellian, how do you define conduct and that sort of thing. By and large, I think the codes of conduct argument is one, because if you go to GitHub, you'll see contributor covenant .md documents, and a lot of free and open source projects are governed by that. As for the meritocracy approach, there's the criticism there is that it's not a meritocracy, it's what's called a pushiocracy, and it's related to the issue with codes of conduct. And that is, instead of the best code bubbling up, it's whoever's the most vociferous in arguing for their code. So, you know, for many years, people would point to Linus Torvalds of Linux and say that that was basically the approach he took, you know, tell people to kill themselves and, you know, your code is terrible, and harassing people until they gave up on contributing. He's since, I think, rightfully apologized and backed away from that sort of approach. So codes of conduct come in to try and establish community norms of, you know, humane behavior to each other, ethics of care towards one another, and allow more and more people to flourish. And this is all important for the Fediverse, because the Fediverse, Mastodon in particular, which is the most popular federated social media, adopted codes of conduct relatively early on. And that became a culture of Mastodon instances. So my instance has a code of conduct. And let's say you're running an instance and you have 200 folks on your instance and you have a code of conduct that's relatively in line with mine in terms of our values. We're more likely to keep that connection going. We're expressing our ethical values to one another. This is something that I call, with a colleague, the covenantal approach. We have an ethical covenant. We all, you know, we have variations on it from community to communities, but we agree and we build out a network that way. And you can see this in action when a network, instance arrives that says, you know, we're free speech absolutists, which typically it's not necessarily typically code for, like, you can say racist stuff. You can be a total asshole to people. And those instances get blocked. That's one of the sanctions there. You know, if you show up, you don't have a code of conduct, and you're letting your members kind of run amok, you'll be blocked. And that's one of the major sanctions that the Fediverse has. So that's the, hopefully, the code of conduct side of things. But you asked a question about the community as well.
Well, I mean, like, there's a couple of rabbit holes there as well, right? That we can go into. Like, you know, I'm generally a proponent of, like, establishing a code of conduct. Like, we do that in, like, you know, in trying to establish norms for contributing to our code bases, for example, just so there is, like, you know, a peaceful discourse, a respect towards one another, and, you know, don't entering, like, flame wars of the 90s or something like this. You know, but then, like, in the case of, like, Linus Torvalds and some, you know, some other people from, like, the Peer-to-Peer Foundation and so on, they've kind of seen the more militant side of other groups coming in, and probably maybe even abusing, you know, codes of conduct or, you know, gaps in there, right? Like, I'm alluding towards, like, you know, the concept of, like, cancel culture, for example. And, like, is there anything that you can introduce into your code of conduct that can, like, help against that? And then, like, even if you could, isn't that, like, kind of the issues with, like, constitutions in a way, right? Like, the nomos actually lives within the people, and, like, the document is good as a kind of material artifact to point to, but it's not ultimately the thing that makes the decisions, right?
Yes. The first thing that I interview a lot of Mastodon and Fediverse administrators, and I talk about codes of conduct with them, and the first thing they'll say is, this is really, really hard. So in the case of somebody being an outright racist, right, that's easy. You know, block them, remove them, ask them to leave, and so on. In the case of somebody who is crossing a line and maybe not realizing it, or like gray areas, I should say, like any sense, it becomes incredibly hard. Here's where I'm hopeful about codes of conduct in terms of the Fediverse. There's a culture on many Fediverse instances of wanting to remain relatively small. If you go to a lot of Mastodon or other federated social media instances, you may run into, you can't sign up, which is just weird I think coming from the world of corporate social media, where they're like, of course, sign up, give us your data, right? They won't shut down their signups. But the reason for that, among many Mastodon and other Fediverse admins, is I want to stay small. I want to keep my instance, 400 people, because that's when I'm comfortable doing content moderation. Mm-hmm. Then you can even start to get to know people. And in those instances, in those cases, I should say, those negotiations over those gray areas become a lot easier. The issue arises more on the bigger instances. When you get like hundreds of thousands of people and you have 10 content moderators, then it becomes very tricky. So one of the things that I like about the Fediverse, I think is very positive, is that many of the instances want to remain small, but they want a big network. So you can imagine a massive network of many small communities all setting their norms and connected to one another. But that doesn't, at the end of the day, as you say, you're absolutely right. These documents are useful, but they don't make the choices. Moderators make choices. And, sometimes you see cases where people have a great code of conduct, but they don't act on it. That becomes an issue on the Fediverse as well. But for me, as an academic looking at social media, I think this is all very valuable. Again, to go back to Meta, to go back to Google and Twitter and so on. If we have an issue like YouTube shadow bans or blocks me or what have you, I can fill out a form. Where does it go? We have a sense that there's somebody somewhere looking at the form, or maybe it's automated. It's handled, through automation or something. I can't talk to anyone at Google, really. I've signed a terms of service agreement saying that if I have a dispute with them, I can't do a class action lawsuit. I have to go into arbitration. I have to go to California, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Whether or not that's enforceable is another thing. But my point is, I can't go to Meta. I can't go to Google and say, what's going on? If I'm on an instance of 400 people, I can go to my admin. I can go to the content moderators and talk, and hopefully there's a civil conversation about, does this behavior violate the code? How so? What can I do? That sort of thing. But it's difficult, but it puts governance in our hands, as opposed to handing it off to big corporations that, as you've mentioned earlier, have very different incentives in building up a community.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, a lot of these sort of big tech platforms, make just a very, very large global village.
Right.
Right. And then what I also don't like about them is then they use algorithms to essentially continue engaging regardless of, and it literally just shreds like any semblance of community in some way. Right.
Indeed.
Approaches like, the Fediverse in general, you have much smaller communities,
right,
and you feel more emotionally attached to them.
Yes.
I find, and you developed, I would consider almost real relationships with the people that are also participating in them. And that's also a reason why I like protocols like Scuttlebutt, for example, right? They all have these unique feels to them. I guess we talked a little bit about the positive aspects of, Mastodon and federated applications. Do you have any critiques of them?
Yeah. I have a chapter on the environmental impacts. And so we talk about these networks as decentralized. The term I prefer to try and deploy is non-centralized, because I'm interested in people building systems that couldn't be centralized, that actively resist centralization. Whether or not that's possible is another matter.
Yeah.
But whatever term we use, non-centralized, decentralized. But if you look at where many Fediverse instances are hosted, they're going to be, exactly where you expect: Amazon Web Services, DigitalOcean, OVH, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So one of my concerns is, we know that, large server farms are energy intensive and tend to use water. Where I came from, I used to live in Utah. There would be a lot of server farms in the high desert of Utah. And so they're going through water, and you can't just put that back into the water table. That water is effectively used up. So can the Fediverse be better in that regard? And right now, I would argue it's not. Now, again, on the same theme of our ability to experiment, it can be. There are people working on running Fediverse servers on low power intensity servers, deleting media files after a certain period of time. So pushing back against the expectation of the infinite scroll, which is one of those, I think, addictive aspects of corporate social media. You know, basically saying, no, we have finite resources. It's not infinite. We can, you know, cut off data storage after a period of time, make things a little bit more ephemeral, maybe reduce the insistence on high definition for everything and try to reduce our environmental impact. But that's all relatively experimental and small scale. And currently, you know, particularly after Elon Musk bought Twitter and we saw that massive uptick of people trying out Mastodon, most of the admins just basically paid for higher tier cloud service plans. And so there's a bit of centralization in this decentralized / non-centralized network, and that needs to be addressed. Another big criticism is pretty easy to guess. It's like, how do we pay for this, right? This doesn't cost nothing. And so, you know, many of these Fediverse instances basically rely on donations from their members. That can be an unreliable source of funding. Some of them have formalized into nonprofit organizations. That's pretty onerous for a lot of people to set up a nonprofit organization.
Sure.
There was an umbrella organization, I say was because I'm not sure what the current status is, called Open Collective, that basically started to collapse. And so a lot of people could join that as a group, and Open Collective would handle the kind of paperwork of being the nonprofit in exchange for a cut of funds, much like Patreon would take a cut of funds. But with that kind of crumbling, there's a lot of Mastodon instances that are a little bit at sea. So as if this network is to become a large network of many small servers, is it sustainable from a, you know, funding perspective? And as soon as you start talking about that, people will start to broach the dominant political economy of the surveillance internet, which is, well, we need to start selling ad space. And that's anathema to many people.
I think you've touched on a lot of the points that I've also come across, right? Particularly when it comes around to the infrastructure, I am not particularly as concerned about the environmental, not because I'm not concerned about it, because I haven't put my mind into thinking about how to solve that problem.
Right.
But, you know, there is almost every system ends up being subject to some kind of power law, which is, you know, one of the issues with trying to keep things non-centralized. But this is, we've been trying to address a lot of the same issues with Waku, for example. So the idea is that, you know, like bandwidth or sending messages, routing messages through the network is not for free, right? And so you need to have a token economy that is able to subsidize or pay for or subsidize that cost. And then who actually subsidizes or pays for that cost is unclear. Like, it can be the users, but like you can also build other mechanisms on top if the community owner wants to help facilitate that. But in doing so, in keeping things as decentralized as possible, in keeping things as decentralized as possible, one of the issues that I see with like the Fediverse is just simply the fact that you have a guardian, let's say, that is running a node. And by virtue, they then have power over that little sectional partition of the network. And so for me, I find it's in order to achieve that goal, you almost need to make the service network that is routing the messages politically agnostic to the actual communities that are building on top of that. And that has some other downstream effects that are positive. So like marginalized communities that might be cut off or cannot access other members that they would like to have associations with. In this system, like, they can still benefit from the entire service network, but also reach them, but have their own internal communities on top of that network.
Yeah.
Like the infrastructure part is a real problem, and like coupling the networks or the infrastructure to the social relations, I think has its benefits. But if you're going up, let's say you are an activist group or you're a dissident of some kind, then those relationships become very clear within the network traffic.
Yeah.
And so in Waku, we try to mitigate that with effectively a next generation remailer, in a way, right? Now it's not without its trade-offs, of course. Like you need to subsidize the costs for like noise traffic in the network.
Yeah.
It can be slower. There's only a certain amount of data that you can put through that. We've had to come up with sophisticated ways of like mitigating spam.
Yes.
We used to rely on proof of work. We're now looking at our rate limiting nullifier using zero knowledge proofs, so you can like have slashing conditions if you start sending too many messages into the network. Okay. And
this is all, I should say, so similar to all the debates in the early days of dark web technologies. You know, you have Freenet, you have Free Haven, which was started by the people who would go on to create Tor. Have the Invisible, or it was initially the Invisible IRC project and the Invisible Internet project, all having these debates about real timeness versus, being able to mix the traffic in such a way that you can obfuscate the connections between people and the cost of the network. These are really, really hard problems to solve. And, if we take those perspectives and use them as lenses to look at the Fediverse falls short in many ways. There's currently no end-to-end encryption. You're absolutely right to say that the admin has a great deal of power. In theory, an admin, this doesn't happen in practice, although it could happen. An admin can go in and look at direct messages and look through databases. So we have a structure there that's like, to go back to Nathan Schneider's critique, that's what he would call implicit feudalism, these little fiefdoms where the admins have a lot of power. So how do you build a non-centralized structure that mitigates against the power of the admin, but do it in a way that satisfies people's desire for like real-timeness or quick connections or connections that prevent others from snooping? Like these are super hard problems.
Right.
I guess so we've kind of talked about, the sort of earlier days and trying to create these anonymizing networks. We've talked, about Mastodon and Fediverse. Are there any sort of other approaches to alternative social media that you find appealing or people should check out that differ in their approaches somehow?
There's one that I really liked, but is pretty much defunct. I think you could still install and run it. It was called Twister. I don't know if you ever saw that.
I can't recall it.
It, like its name implies, was meant to be a Twitter alternative, but it was fully peer-to-peer using, I do believe it used blockchain and BitTorrent, distributed hash tables. And, you're talking to an English major. It's like, there are going to be limits to my ability to explain these technical things.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it was really fascinating because this was a system that, ran, I didn't run it on my phone or ran it locally on a desktop, but it functioned like Twitter and I had followers and followed relationships. And it was a little on the slower side, but it was pretty effective. And the person who designed it, a person by the name of Miguel Freitas, was inspired by protests in Brazil. And he realized that protesters were using Twitter, and he basically saw the writing on the wall that the Brazilian state could come in and just knock on Twitter's door and say, give us data on the activists. Much as you're saying, activists using these networks are de facto mapping their activist networks, right? And that's really dangerous. So Miguel Freitas made this system that used peer-to-peer protocol. So the data, lived on your end device. It wasn't accessible to any central authority, including him. So I thought that was really fascinating. But I think one of the downsides to a project like that is that I don't know why he stopped, but he maybe burned out. You know, like, this is a major issue too. Is a lot of times these, it's another point of centralization. A lot of times these things fall on one or a few people to develop. And if they, life happens or what have you, it can fall apart. So what I'm interested in part in my current work is underlying protocols. So I've been studying ActivityPub, which is the major Fedivorce protocol. But there's other ones, Noster, and there's AT protocol, which is made by Blue Sky. So there's a lot of different approaches to try and address that problem to build in the infrastructural level, and then people build on top of it. And that seems to be the longest term, the thing that's most viable long term, at least in my view, is something that is open. But
go ahead. Yeah, I mean, like, bootstrapping like these networks are incredibly difficult, right? Like, they are effectively, you know, at least a two-sided market. And, you know, you have the chicken and egg problem. You need to have the, you know, the, both the supply and the demand. And, you know, Mastodon's been around for a while. And, you know, thanks to Black Swan events like Elon Musk buying Twitter, it's seen influxes. But I don't know if you've had much thought on like how these social networks can bootstrap themselves, or where does it all start, you know, in building a community?
Yeah, in the case of Mastodon specifically, I have a chapter on this. It's you use the Black Swan idea. It's really accidental and contingent, right? And so as purposeful as people can be, historical accidents end up mattering a great deal. So in the case of Mastodon, that project started in 2016, and it ran on a protocol called OStatus, which in many ways is the predecessor to the current protocol ActivityPub. OStatus was the protocol that GNU Social, which was a federated, it's still in existence, I should say, federated microblogging system, used OStatus. A few other projects use OStatus as well. The Mastodon's using OStatus, but one of the issues that they ran into is that you don't get a lot of privacy in OStatus. The O is open. And I talked to one of the key figures there, a person by the name of Evan Perdromu. And he said, yeah, like when I was helping develop OStatus, I was caught up in the Web 2.0, like just be totally open and transparent on the internet. That's the way to go approach. So not thinking about privacy. Mastodon's using this OStatus. The O becomes an issue because if you're trying to send a more private message to a few followers, the only way you could really do it would be to flag that message as private, and then it flows across the network. And you can imagine, we mentioned the admin problem. You know, if you see you're an admin and you're running an instance, you see something flagged private, you know, you can just open it up. In fact, people had shared messages from people, and that was very difficult for folks. So at the same time, the World Wide Web Consortium is making ActivityPub, and they are thinking about addressing and how to route messages to particular people. The interesting thing, and this is something I write about in the book, is that when the W3C was making these federated social media protocols, no big company wanted to get involved. They reached out to Facebook, they reached out to Twitter, they reached out to a few other major players, and all of them were just like, oh, go ahead, we don't care. They basically benign neglect. And so the people making these protocols had a free hand, and they designed a protocol the way they liked. And because none of these big companies were involved, when Mastodon showed up, Mastodon had like, you know, maybe 500,000 people using it. So not small, but not big. But they were the biggest ones to adopt ActivityPub. And that, you know, speaking of legitimacy, legitimated ActivityPub. Here's this third party implementing it. So because of that, ActivityPub survives. Mastodon survives. It's a real historical accident, just a meeting of these two different projects. How do you plan for that, right?
Right. You know, it's very organic. Multivariates. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, why are, I mean, this is one of my major fields of studies is science and technology studies. And you really get into contingency, like the classic example, the Betamax versus VHS. Like Betamax was technically superior, but VHS wins. It's not because of technical things. It's because of social practices and accidents and all these other factors that you really, you can't control for. So you, the only thing you can do is build and try and think about enrolling social groups and social actors to build that legitimacy and build out your network. And it's really hard. It's really hard work.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm kind of curious, speaking like of legitimacy, like how, like where does the legitimacy fit into all of this? And like, how do you think about it?
Yeah, I was poking around the dark web and I came across a counterfeit money forum. I think somebody selling counterfeit $20 US bills. And somebody was talking about how they would rub like graphite on it from a pencil and rub it against the edge of a table to make it legit, make these 20s legit so you could pass it off. Here they pass it off at a store, and I just struck by that idea that like, no, this is not legitimate. You know, there's no state in the world is gonna like, they states defend the ability to coin money, right? Like, you know, it's not legitimate to the store owner who's accepting this $20 bill, but it's legit in the sense of like creativity and artistry, however we feel about the passing of counterfeit dollars. So that moment kind of triggered like, well, what does it mean for something to be legit? And I dove into the literature and found that there's these different, it's a very complicated term, and it becomes this kind of trifocal lens that I could look at objects with. And so if you go to Max Weber's theory of the state, a state is an entity that makes a legitimate claim or legitimated claim to the monopoly on violence. And so a state is an entity that says we have a military and we have a police and we can end your life legitimately. And there's a claim aspect there that's important, right? Your states continually have to make that claim. And of course, the counter to that is disputing that claim, pushing back against that claim. So the ability to speak and critique a state is a dangerous act, but it's a necessary act if we don't want to have states that just have carte blanche on our lives. So there's that aspect of legitimacy, the legitimacy of the state, or the claims of legitimacy states make and our ability as citizens to dispute those claims. And then there's legitimate business. And here I was thinking about the discourse about the Silk Road drug market. And I found that they were in the business press. You can see people saying, wow, this thing is making lots and lots of money. There's almost this jealousy that it's not a legitimate business that we can get into. Like the, and, you know, fast forward to now with, legalization of marijuana or de facto decriminalization of marijuana. And we see businesses popping up, like it's a massive growth sector. So this idea of a legitimate business, and then there's the that first legitimacy that I mentioned, which is the more creative or
it's legit, bro.
Yeah, relational aspect. Like to be a legit hacker is you have to traffic in certain things and you have to be, you can't make a claim to, I can't say I'm legit. You have to tell me I'm legit, right? It's very relational.
Right.
It's like saying, you know,
I'm cool. Tie into like reputation?
Yeah, exactly. Then? That's right. Yeah. And so if you look at any of these projects, they have to really think about all three levels. You know, the creators of these anonymous networks have to make claims about, we are protecting your capacity to critique the state.
Right.
In order to do that, you need to have, and they would use the figure of the dissident as the, I think you reach for that figure too. Like we need the dissident to be capable of using our network because the stakes are extremely high. The dissident will be killed.
The dissident is the one that's making a dispute against that claim of legitimacy, right? Yeah.
And then you have these organizations making their software. They have to have legitimate organizational structure. So they're free and open source software projects. They need to attract volunteers. They need to attract donations. So they have to calculate at that level. And that's where you get into interesting things like the ambiguous relationship between the Tor project and the U.S. government, right?
Right.
One hand they get funding, one other hand, you know, their NSA is trying to break their encryption and so on, right?
Signal is in the same bucket, right?
Exactly.
Like,
partially it's, you know, it, when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, she talked about the Internet Freedom Agenda. And that was, you know, we need to spread these encryption technologies to protect the dissidents as long as they're, you know, out there.
Right. Not internal.
Yeah. And then, you know, you have the level of, you know, the Tor project versus I2P versus Freenet, and who's legit, who's the real hackers, who's the real, like, who's really making good software. And so you have all these layers, and like it gets pretty complicated. And so I talk about like ways to exchange legitimacy across these different layers.
Right.
But most of us have to operate in those same ways. I mean, I can point to academics doing the same sort of thing, like thinking about the relationship to states, relationship to an organization, relationships to networks of reputation.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I certainly started this journey with being influenced by, you know, Free Haven, Tor, you know, I2P, NuNet, ZeroNet, and so on. But particularly like I2P and Tor in why like privacy mattered, right? Yeah. From making these kinds of claims against, you know, state legitimacy. So for me, like privacy is like a non-negotiable. It's necessary for like the right to associate and freedom of expression, right? Then, from my side, like I'm very interested in trying to realize the unrealized dream, a latent dream of the cyberpunks to create like a cyber state or virtual state, as you know, like Barlow and Peter Ludlow and Jerry Everard have been talking about. And so this legitimacy through propriety, like basically building institutions on top of public blockchains that are effectively agnostic to their use. They can potentially be corruption and censorship free. Of course, they are not... like a set of values are encoded into those contracts, but that's aside from the point. But the fact that they gain their legitimacy through usage, through voluntary usage, is really fascinating to me. But one thing that had kind of come to me recently was this notion of like popular sovereignty. You know, I think in your book, you talk about how I2P, you know, points at illegal activity happening in their network as proof that, you know, your rights are quote unquote secured. And I find like that really, really fascinating because it is basically demarking like a territory or jurisdiction in cyberspace and upholding it. But that is upheld by effectively consent of the governed. Like the people participating in that network are wanting to be to have the rights that network bestows upon them and the governance structures that are then imposed on them.
Yeah.
And I find that really, really fascinating. I don't know if you've considered that at all or thought about that.
It comes up too in the penultimate chapter where I talk about the development of HTTPS certificates on Tor onions, which it still makes me laugh because like your connection to a Tor onion site is encrypted and it's verified cryptographically, so you don't need a certificate saying. But their Facebook actually got involved at the IETF to create these extended validation certificates because Facebook wanted to set up a Tor hidden service, but they didn't want what would inevitably happen, which is a bunch of clones of Facebook appearing. And essentially what Facebook and the Tor project did was they used the Silk Road as justification. They said, you know, we are important. Look at the Silk Road. We're capable of protecting this drug market. It's very popular. It has a lot of users. Therefore, we're an important project and we should have be able to get our EV... requests for comments through the standards process. I found that to be a really fascinating moment. Yeah, and again, thinking about the relationship to the state, we reach for the dissident as a figure to hold up. But in practice, what we end up holding up when we talk about these networks is criminal actors. You know, if somebody can break the law, by you know, definition, a dissident is probably a lawbreaker, criminal as well in the eyes of a particular state.
Right.
But people don't reach for the criminal as the figure to say we're effective, unless you push, and then push come to shove, the networks will say, well, look, criminals are using our network. And as distasteful as you find that, it is a sign that we are effective at protecting people from the eyes of the state.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that sort of protection of like illicit activity. Do you think that's synonymous with the dark web, and it should be characterized that way? Or like, how do you think, or is it broader than that?
I do think I've seen so many different uses for dark web technologies. I mentioned at the outset that the reason I got interested in it was because of social networking sites on the dark web. And so just kind of to give you the story there, when I saw that, I was like, oh, that's pretty interesting, but it's probably full of trolls and noxious people. And I went there and found that, you know, people were debating politics in a relatively civil manner and on the dark web. And I thought, well, that's pretty fascinating. And I dug a little deeper and found that there was a group dedicated to feminist politics. So like, that's, I did not expect that. It shattered a lot of expectations I had about a network full of trolls or drug dealers or what have you, right? And so as I dug through, I found all these different uses, like people building search engines, people playing chess, like normal internet activities. But alongside that, of course, you know, the most notorious sites are going to be ones like the drug markets and now I think the markets for stolen personal information, because, you know, you don't even need to put that in the mail. You can just send the stolen information to people. Journalists being journalists, of course, love having good stories. And so they're going to highlight those uses of the dark web over other uses. And at the same time, you also see, if you go to SecureDrop's website, you'll see tons of news outlets that operate SecureDrop for anonymous whistleblowing. And you can go to an Onion site, and here in Canada, I can provide data to the CBC over the Tor network to anonymously blow the whistle on somebody. But the coverage has been, it's full of, you know, black hat hackers, and it's full of drug dealers, it's full of child exploiters and so on. And the unfortunate side effect of that is that, you know, that's what people think it's for. And I think that social construction of the dark web as for these activities is a very powerful force.
Great.
And that leads to people saying, well, we should stop developing these technologies because they're being used by criminals. And I think that would be a mistake, because I think, like you, anonymous or private communication is really essential to our capacity to have political discourse. Having that backstop, even if we don't use it, having that backstop in place.
Safeguards against tyranny, in a way.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. And I use Signal. I get my family and my friends on Signal because I believe that that's going to be better for us than even WhatsApp. I wouldn't trust WhatsApp.
No.
I mean, that's precisely because, like, I'm just talking about stuff with my family, but that's private. And that's our place to be who we are. And I don't really want that subject to any prying eyes. And we need that sort of system. But I kind of get a little ambivalent in the conclusion of my book. You know, I basically argue, if we believe that this is a network for criminals, it will be a network for criminals. And we will be more likely to support calls to have it shut down, or criminal, you know, backdoors and encryption put in and all that stuff. And I think that's very dangerous, and also eliminates a viable channel for political communication.
How do you think we can change that perception, or like change that sort of narrative around these technologies?
Well, you know, making it a day-to-day practice is a good way to go. And so, as much as, you know, we might critique some of the big tech companies when they put in an end-to-end encryption, if they do it the right way, and not with some sort of backdoor, celebrate that and use it, and you know, make that part of just an expectation that we have, you know. I don't believe that people still adhere to that I have nothing to hide attitude that I think was prevalent about a decade ago. I think people do know, like, I talk to my students at university, and they know, like, there's all sorts of ways they're monitored. There's all sorts of ways they're surveilled, and they don't particularly care for it, and they look for ways around it. So there's, I think, a big undercurrent of people who would support these technologies and use them. But as I'm sure you know, it's, we're competing with people who make them user-friendly or make
convenience.
And you fight an uphill battle about design and user interfaces and ease of use and real-timeness and the expectation of seemingly infinite storage. That's an uphill battle.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, I think we've pretty much covered like the main topics that I wanted to chat to you about. We talked a little bit about identity and like your participation in these communities. I'm kind of curious, like, if you had any reflections on that at all.
I did. I interviewed somebody for my Fediverse book who basically said using the Fediverse has transformed me as a person. And that really resonated with me, that this is something that people consistently say about online interaction. There's, you know, kind of a, we can be dismissive of it and say it's not real. It's very real to people. The ability to connect to each other over digital networks and become different people through those interactions. And I looking back, I kind of want to work through this. It's in the back of my mind. I want to compare how I concluded my first book, which came out in 2014, to how I'm conceptualizing this book now, and think about all the differences, all the changes that I've gone through because I've interacted with people in anonymized environments and on the Fediverse. And, you know, I didn't give much thought to something like a code of conduct as a document that can condition the ethics of connections. And now I do. And yeah, I think using digital networks has changed me, and hopefully for the better. But I do need to reflect on that a little bit more. It's you know, having time to sit down and reflect sometimes is a luxury.
Yeah, I hear that. Is there any other topics that you would like to discuss or bring up that might be relevant to your book coming out?
There is. You mentioned the power law. The Fediverse is now going to be like very much in that kind of structure because Meta has adopted ActivityPub, so for Threads, which is their Twitter alternative, and that's been a major point of debate on the Fediverse. And so I do have a chapter focusing on the debate over whether or not to federate with Threads. And the argument against, I think you'll hear this very well, you know, this is not a good actor. You know, Meta has some terrible content moderation practices. I just read this morning, it's being sued by my local school board because it's addictive to kids. Putting profits over people's growth, even aiding and abetting genocides around the world. This is not a good actor. We should not federate with them. And there's a counter argument that this is an open network. Anyone can join, and it's up to individuals to make the choice of whether or not to connect to people on Threads. I come down on the first side because of my history critiquing Meta / Facebook over the years. I don't think they're a particularly responsible actor. And moreover, it denies my interest in lots of little communities branching out and making those purposeful decisions to connect to one another. And instead, we have a network of 100 million people arriving. But that could be the death knell for the Fediverse in many ways. You know, if Threads becomes this dominant entity, it could become de facto centralized network all over again.
Possibly. It reminds me of Jabber or XMPP, I think it's called, and you know, Google adopting it, right? And once Google basically decided to drop support for the protocol. It effectively killed the protocol.
Yeah. That's a big concern. And that's what a lot of people, that's the exact example people reach for to say how dangerous this can be.
That would be my concern.
Yeah. Another concern that I have is that the activity protocol actually has two parts. One governs the server to server connections, and the other governs client to server connections. The only one that really gets implemented of those two is the server to server connection. Most people don't implement client to server because Mastodon had an API for that prior to their adopting ActivityPub. So basically, people either adopt the Mastodon API if they're building clients, or they adapt variations on it. Mastodon's no longer the big player. It's going to be Meta. And so they could dominate the client to server aspect of the API, and that could be very dangerous as well.
Right.
Well, I guess on that happy note, we're out of time at the moment, but like, there's plenty of other things that I'd love to discuss with you. Like, I wasn't aware that you were involved in governance, and like, there's also the archive that I'd like to discuss with you at some point. Maybe we can have a chat later in the future.
Yeah,
but. Really appreciated your perspective on both anonymizing networks and alternate social media, and I'm really looking forward to your new book, Move Slowly and Build Bridges, come out. And I guess on that note, given the discussions we've had, not to put you on the spot, but is there any other recommended readings that come to mind that we should probably check out or include in the material when this podcast goes out?
Oh, of mine.
Of yours, or anything that you might find interesting or relevant?
Well, I mentioned Nathan Schneider's work, his book, it is Governable Spaces. Governable Spaces, yeah. I'm going to have to leave it at that because I'm staring at my library looking things up. But cool. That's a book that's, I think, going to be important for me to wrestle with for the reasons we mentioned about the power of admins and like, basically, the thing I'm wrestling with now is like, what is the atomic unit here? Are we talking individuals? Are we talking small collectives? Are we talking networks? And if we have those different perspectives, it changes how we think about the ethical connections between each other. There's different ethical theories that go with each. And maybe there's a pluralist approach, but it's very, very hard to implement a pluralist approach when we're looking at these different perspectives.
Yeah. I mean, the notion of the individual, I am not as assured in that concept as I used to be.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah.
I guess I'm very conscious of the time that we. I don't want to take up too much of your time, but definitely appreciate spending time with you, and definitely learn a lot. Thank you,
Jared.